You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. This is the May episode and I'm joined by Eric, who you may remember from last year's episode on Charlie Kaufman's Synecdoche, New York. Hey, Eric.
Hi, Matt.
And we're also joined by a new guest, Patrick Martignoni. Hey, Patrick.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Eric.
To begin with, since you're new to our listeners, do you perhaps just want to say a couple of things about yourself?
Well, I know you, Matt, for quite some time, and as a film buffs, and kind of, you always ask me if I would join you on time for this podcast, and now I'm here, and I'm scared like whatever. I usually work in theatre as director, and I'm teaching as well, and my interest in animation is quite high. I always was attracted to animation, which is the topic today. Let's see what we'll have to chat about.
So as you've already said, we will be talking about animation and more specifically about anime, and even more specifically, we will be talking about one of the godfathers, I would say, of Japanese animation. Not the one that some of you might be expecting, but the other one. So we will be talking about Isao Takahata. I'm hoping that I'm pronouncing this correctly, but I'm hoping that you guys can help me with this a bit. So to begin with, we have not talked about anime or animation on the podcast before. So let's perhaps just quickly talk about what our own experiences are with anime. To begin with, this might be different for me than it would be perhaps for American listeners or English listeners, because I grew up in Switzerland in the 80s, and a lot of the stuff that we had on kids' TV was actually Japanese animation. And strangely enough, it was a lot of Japanese animation of European classics, European children's books. So the animation that I remember from when I was a kid is stuff like The Wonderful Adventures of Niels, also known as Niels Holgersson, which is based on a Swedish children's novel. I remember the anime on Pinocchio, and obviously born in Switzerland, raised in Switzerland, I remember Heidi, but I remember Heidi in the anime version. So I grew up with a Japanese version of the iconic Swiss children's tale. Beyond that, I think I still grew up with this prejudice against anime that it was samey, that it was cheaply made, that it was heavily based on tropes, which is, of course, silly and also very Eurocentric, because, I mean, the other big animation that I grew up with, Disney, was also filled with tropes, but I think I was just way less aware of it. And it's only later that I got to modern classics such as Akira, Ghost in the Shell, and then very quickly the Miyazaki films, starting with Princess Mononoke. So this is how I came to anime myself. What about you, Eric?
I think that, you know, my experience mirrors yours quite a fair bit, with the exception that mine's a little more cliched. So I grew up watching TV, Saturday morning specials, all of that. And probably my first introduction to anime was my six-year-old mind seeing Robotech on the screen. This is quite fairly, it's a classic, really. A classic of something being completely butchered, if you actually look at the history of Robotech. Because it was two shows mashed together, right, for an American audience. And me, my young six-year-old mind, not really understanding that, but seeing, hey, cool robots, cool explosions, and there's this weird melodrama in the middle. It was quite a confusing combination for me, but the art style, that was what stood out for me, because I'd never seen that kind of, you know, flashy animation and that kind of detail in something before. It was like we were opening up a different window altogether compared to, you know, the old Looney Tunes shorts and Tom and Jerry, which was what I would have been watching at that time. So that was my subconscious experience of it. I think the second awakening really was in my teens, when there was a channel called AXN that was used to playing, again, big, flashy, explosive stuff, right? Again, tailored for teens. And they had an anime night every night, and it was completely a blast because that was my first experience with Akira. Also my first experience with body horror, at which point I realized that, okay, so animation's probably not just for kids then. And I was a kid at the time, so it was quite the eye-opener. But that's what really stoked my interest at that point. And I know it's very cliched, a lot of people have had that experience, but then I discovered Miyazaki, and then, you know, I think that's when the real awakening happened. And that was really my experience with anime.
I guess it's quite similar as growing up in Switzerland to your experiences. I got into animation as through TV, like Tom and Jerry and this kind of stuff, like American cartoons, but as well the Japanese TV series. At that point, I was not aware that they were Japanese, really, of course. I remember watching like UFO Robo-Grandizer on French TV, and even if I didn't understand a word, I really loved it. And of course, the tamer Japanese TV series as Heidi or Honeybee Maya or Pinocchio or whatever. The cinema was predominantly Disney, and I loved them. On the other hand, for TV, I really liked Japanese animation, and I don't really know why, but actually, I think it seems to be the quality level, like of Heidi or Marco, which are both shows produced and directed by Takahata, which I found out much later, of course. This level always intrigued me. This quality, the detail and backgrounds and everything, it seemed so realistic. Maybe we will come to that later on, like Miyazaki, who always, it's like always a team. It's not, you cannot talk about Takahata without Miyazaki because they often work together. But it already showed it, even if these were just TV series at the time. But later on, I guess it was Akira that opened my eyes to Japanese animation. I remember it, seeing it on the big screen, and I was overwhelmed. And Ghost in the Shell and all this kind of, it was just that much more than Disney movies could offer to me. From then on, my interest got more and more into animation. And of course, then I discovered Miyazaki and realized how everything's connected. It's really interesting, animation. You grow up or you think it's just for kids, and then you realize, oh no, there is another world as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that thing about animation just being as kids, as I said, Princess Mononoke was one of the key experiences I had myself. And I went actually to another city to see it at the cinema because they weren't showing it in my own city. It was an evening show. It was 8 o'clock, and I sat there, and then two young parents came in with a kid, a boy who looked about 7 or 8 years old. And 5 minutes later, when the film started, you had bloodshed that was pretty graphic compared to, yeah, the American animation that we were used to. And I think that family, they left very early, but it was so clear. They thought, okay, animation, it's for kids. And something like Princess Mononoke, I think most people would not show that to their 7-year-olds necessarily. Since you also have a bit more of background with Japan, do you perhaps want to just tell us a couple of things about Isao Takahata, just to frame a bit the conversation that's going to follow?
Isao Takahata was born, obviously, in Japan in 1935 in Uchiyamada, which is, it's not far from Osaka or Kyoto. And when he was 9 years old, he survived a major American air raid. He moved to Tokyo and graduated from university with a degree in French literature. At that point, when he was studying, he had no plans to go into animation business or film business. But when he's asked about how he got into it, he always mentions the French movie La Bergère et le Ramoneur by Paul Grimaud. And he uses a lot of abstract themes and drawings when you look at it. So Takahata, as a student, he was extremely impressed by this and thought that this might be really interesting to get into the possibilities you have with animation. He always, as well, had no interest in drawing. He always said that he cannot draw. He always was a director and writer, and he was very pedantic and I think not so easy to work with, I guess, because he was always over time, because he was not happy with what everybody delivered, because he had a very precise idea what he wanted to get. He first got a job at Toei Animation as an assistant director, where he worked on TV shows and got his first opportunity for a feature film in 1968. That was Horus, Prince of the Sun, which is also known in English-speaking countries as Little Norse Prince. This is actually the first time he worked together with Hayao Miyazaki, an animator at Toei. And I think they really clicked together. And what's important to know about Horus is that the studio was probably not that keen on what they, how it ended up. Because if you have seen the movie, it's set in Scandinavia, but it originally had been meant to happen in Hokkaido. And it's based on a tale of Ainu culture. Ainu are like the indigenous people of northern Japan. And at that time, they were rather suppressed. So Ainu people were not allowed to speak their own language. They had to speak Japanese. And still today, it is quite an issue in Hokkaido. Everybody knew that there are things going on that shouldn't. So for Toy, it was quite a difficult thing to have a film in Ainu culture. And so it was a political thing behind it. So they had to change it to Scandinavia. And actually, parts of the movie already had been produced when they changed it. So it's quite interesting that they already had this political background. We will find that again. It's a recurring theme for Takahata and what he wants to tell through movies. Well, in the end, Horus was no success at all. It was no commercial success, and Takahata had to be an assistant director again, and he was not allowed to do a major feature again at Toei, which is the reason why Takahata and Miyazaki, they left Toei and wanted to find some other place. The next step they made was when they moved to a production company. They had the idea of doing a Pippi Longstocking TV series. This never happened because of Astrid Lindgren, because she was at the time quite protective about her character and her books. So they didn't get the rights. One of the next things we have to mention in the stepping stones of Takahata's career is two short movies. They're called Panda Ko Panda, which means like panda and baby panda. And you clearly see all the work they put already into Pippi Longstocking, because the little girl is there. She lives alone in a house because her grandmother has to leave. So she's alone, and a small panda baby appears, and they live together, and then the father of this panda arrives as well, and those two pandas formed a new family for this girl. And so she she has crazy adventures with them. And there is a second short movie. Both are like a half hour long. It's about circus and the flooding. But they don't really care about the flooding. They think it's cool because they can like be on boats and stuff. And you already feel, when you know Miyazaki movies, you find like Donari no Totoro there, because like the way the panda moves and behaves, it's like Totoro. Then you have like Ponyo. You find Ponyo with the underwater stuff. It's already there. And it's fun to see in retrospect. From this on, they started their work, both Takahata as director and Miyazaki as... he did all the layouts for the TV series of Heidi. Heidi, the Girl of the Alps, is probably another very important step for Takahata's career. And it was probably is the first children's TV series that has a focus on realism. Takahata wanted to show everyday life. He was not that interested in adventure and fantastical stuff, but he actually wanted to show reality. And they are actually very, very close to the original, except for the Christian motives you find in the original books by Johannes Spyri. It's a shame. I remember, like here in Switzerland, when you would read about the TV series, everybody said, oh, it's cheap and they do just what they want with the story. But actually, Takahata's vision of Heidi comes probably closest to the books themselves. And for evolution of a Japanese TV series, it was the first TV series where the production team actually traveled to Switzerland and to Germany to scout locations. They would take pictures, and so it's very accurate when you watch the series. And at the same time, is another aspect of Takahata is that it's melancholic. At times, it's very dark and somber. And it's a thing that is really interesting if you compare it to other children's shows at the time. Heidi was a real success in Japan and internationally later on. Day went on, and through Heidi, this series of European children's classics started. It was called World Masterpiece Theatre. His interest was always like with children, teenagers, and it was with his international classics. But at one point after that, he really wanted to focus more on Japan. And after leaving World Masterpiece Theatre Series, he worked on a new TV series that was called Chia the Brat, which is totally focused in Japan. It's about a girl. It's based on a manga. It's based on a family, dysfunctional family in Osaka. And it is really highly funny. And it is at the same time very, very sad because it's a girl, Chia. She's 8 years old and she runs the family restaurant and her father is a gambler and he's Yakuza and he is really rude and he means well, but he is, if there is trouble, it's because of her father. Father and mother are separated and she in between like meets her mother in a park and this is like the only time when she feels she can be a child. But next to that, she works in this restaurant and it is worth to be discovered for everyone, and it's not widely available, but you might be lucky on DVD or online. From this on, he really stayed with Japanese culture. He did a movie, Ghost Cellist, a mild, nice, really charming movie as well. After that, I think the period started with Miyazaki, because Miyazaki produced his own manga, Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, which is kind of like the first Ghibli, but it is pre-Ghibli because Ghibli was founded after Nausicaä. Miyazaki asked Takahata to produce Nausicaä, so they worked together again, and he was also asked by Miyazaki to be a co-founder of Ghibli. So both are like the fathers of Ghibli Studio. But he found that he had to be different from Miyazaki. And it's not that they were like, of course, their interests or what they wanted to tell through film was a whole different thing. But Takahata really expressly, he really wanted to be different than Miyazaki. So he just felt it was important for the sake of Ghibli. He died in 2018 at the age of 82. And it is important to know that he was recognized as an important director, mostly in his last years, when like Kaguya Hime was nominated for an Oscar. And a year after his death, there was a special exhibition held at the National Museum of Modern Art in Tokyo. And this is one of the most prestigious venues in Japan. So Takahata was the very first and so far the only creator of Japanese animation whose works were put on exhibition at the museum. It shows the importance that he has and that is recognized now.
Thank you very much for this introduction, which also does provide context and obviously a lot of the topics that you've already alluded to will pop up in our discussion. We will focus on four films, as you've said, Grave of the Fireflies, then Only Yesterday and Pompoko, kind of together, and finally The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. We might touch upon some of the other films as well, but these are going to be our stepping stones in our discussion of Takahata's films and his work. Let's start with Grave of the Fireflies. It was the first Takahata film I watched myself, and it was one of the early anime movies that I watched that also gave me an idea of what the form can do and what it can be. Because before that, I mainly saw anime either as a format for children's tales or kind of genre fare, fantasy, science fiction. And this Grave of the Fireflies was very clearly grown-up animation with adult themes, war, loss, also the national loss of face that Japan underwent during the Second World War. At the same time, you've got the main characters who are an adolescent and a child. So in some ways, visually, aesthetically, I sat there watching something that didn't look 100% different from some of the other anime series I'd seen, but it was done in service of a much more adult story. And that tension I find very interesting. It's amazing to me that when the film came out, it was part of a double bill with Miyazaki's My Neighbor Totoro. And I think, at least from a Western perspective, I find that would basically cause whiplash just in terms of, you know, you've got My Neighbor Totoro, which is a wonderfully sweet, beautiful tale of childhood. And then you've got a tale of childhood that is very much the opposite of sweet in the end. I'll come to an end soon, but I'll just want to give a quick summary of what the film is about. So you've got these two children, a teenage boy and his young sister, trying to survive in late World War II Japan. Their mother dies as the result of the firebombing of Kobe in 1945. The two children stay with an aunt for a while, but the boy, Seita, and the aunt dislike one another, and he and his sister move into an abandoned bomb shelter where you've got this almost idealized period for a while. It's where they can be free, where they can be children to some extent, but of course it's illusory. It cannot last, and Seita cannot provide a living for himself or for his sister. And she dies of malnutrition, and later he dies too. I think what struck me very much about the film, especially compared to Miyazaki, is how much it's set in a real world. I do think that both Miyazaki and Takahata share an interest in depicting things also realistically, especially their characters. But of course, this is set in the real world. And I think, if I remember correctly, there had been suggestions that the short story that the film is based on, that it could be made into live-action film, but this didn't happen, at least not initially. I think they later made live-action versions in 2005 and 2008, but I think the anime format is actually a good fit because of how it can straddle realism and stylization. Because, let's face it, I mean, Grave of the Fireflies is quite gruesome in parts, and I think the animation, just because it is stylized, it perhaps gives us a certain distance to the material. When the mother is first badly hurt in the firebombing and then dies, you have scenes where we see her corpse. It's covered with maggots. It's not gratuitous, but it is very far from the world in that respect that we see in Miyazaki films. It's a film that I think depicts the hardship of the common civilians during war in a way that I've not found in any other film. And in that respect, it's extremely striking. It's very, very strong. Eric, since you've now had a bit of a break, what was your experience of watching Grave of the Fireflies when you first watched it, but perhaps also if you watched it more recently?
Right. So when I first watched Grave of the Fireflies, I was wholly unprepared for what I was about to watch. What people had told me was, well, you know, you need to watch this movie. And I was like, okay, it's anime, and I might as well. And it's the kind of experience that, you know, in the moment, you know, hits you, but you only realize how much in the days and weeks after you've actually seen it. I wasn't really expecting it to be an easy watch, but just the level of raw humanity that animation was able to depict. And this was coming off after a Miyazaki film, right? I mean, I actually, when you say it's a double bill, I'd actually seen Totoro right before that. And I was like, okay. All right. Like you mentioned, Whiplash, right? And after I'd seen the movie, and, you know, it is quite a, and it's not a comment on war. I don't think it's a commentary on war as such, but it's just a commentary on what happens to people when, you know, things are beyond their control. Also, it's based on a short story, a semi-autobiographical short story by the author. I think his name is Akiyuki Nosaka. And the interesting thing about this is that it's really not about even the war as such, but it's more about the attitudes people had during wartime. And I think that's what hit me the most of all, because I don't know if you both asked yourselves this question, but I kept asking myself, why didn't Seita just go back to his aunt and suck up his pride and honor and just, you know, let them live? Mm-hmm. Because was it really worth it in the end, both of them succumbing to malnutrition and scabies? So that was what hit me most for the longest time. But, you know, I think I understand the mindset of why this went that way. But that was the thing that hit me when I first saw Grave of the Fireflies.
Yeah, I think those are definitely very important points. And I could imagine there are also points there where for a Western audience, the film comes across slightly differently, probably than for a Japanese audience. Patrick, what about you?
When I first saw it, I actually was in the United States and I found it as a VHS on a VHS tape, and I was not prepared. I just knew that this is a Takahata movie, and I did not know anything really about it. So it was really shocking experience. I was shocked by the ending, but probably because I didn't expect it to be as realistic and as, yeah, no happy ending and what. But later on, I think it's the same as Eric says, is when you ask to think about how, why is this boy not asking for help? I mean, his relatives, they don't live far. I mean, he's just at the outskirts of the place where he has relatives. And he gets into this like fantasy world with his sister, and he actually watches her die. I mean, he goes to see a doctor, but he doesn't change his mind. And I've read it was quite an issue, and people were not, they didn't understand why Takahata showed this character alike. I mean, of course, it's based on a book, but I think he actually said that he was surprised that people felt really bad and sad for this boy, because he actually thought that this, he wanted to show this boy not being able to cope with the situation. They actually missed the end of the war. I mean, he doesn't know that the war is over. And the way we said, it's this realism, it's an extreme realism where you have to ask yourself, why not doing it in the first place as a live action movie?
I mean, the thing, again, as I said, I think it probably, the film comes across differently for a Western audience. It's easy to watch what Saita does as normal, you know, this individualistic, you're going to solve the problems by yourself. And if that means that you have to, you know, steal food, so be it. The aunt is clearly presented as not very sympathetic. But as you said, Eric, I mean, you ask yourself after a certain point, or you should ask yourself after a certain point, is it just pride, or is it mostly pride that brings Saita into this situation where, in a way, he causes or at least contributes to the death of Setsuko? The other thing, the realism, I think one thing I found very interesting about the film there is, I totally agree, the film is very realistic. I think it's realistic in its depiction. It starts with a conceit that is not realistic. I mean, we start off the film at the very end. We see Saita, I think, in a train station or a subway station. Right. There's other young boys there, and they're basically, many of them are already dead. Many of them are dying of malnutrition, of hunger. And we see Saita alone dying. And then we see his ghost witnessing and remembering. So there is, in a way, this conceit that is, you could say, non-realistic with the ghost. But even that conceit, it's not handled in any fantastic way. It's there to frame the story as witnessing what happens, which I think adds to the melancholy air. But what do you do with that with that starting point that, in a way, works a bit against the realism?
I think that it works in a couple of ways. I mean, the first is to tell you that, okay, this is the way the story ended. But it also helps you understand that this is a story about how these two lives have ended. So it doesn't give you, hold out hope for you in the right at the beginning and tell you that, okay, you're going to see a difficult story and maybe they survive at the end. That's very clear cut. You're going to see exactly what's going to happen to these people and how they got to where they did. That's the first one. And I think the second reason for them doing the fantastical framing around the story is because it also gives you a very, if you look at it, and of course, here I'm going to skip right to the end. It provides you another bit where, you know, maybe the story does end on a very glum note, but it also shows you that, hey, in the end, they did what they could and now they're together and you see them walking off the screen, right? I mean, you see them at the train station and you see them going away, which is, I guess, a way you can get some sort of satisfaction out of that narrative. I think that's two reasons why you do that as somebody who would create the story or at least put that framework around it. But it's just more or less a way to show you that here's their journey, this is the end of the journey, and we're going to show you exactly why you need to care about these people. That's the way I took it, anyway.
I think it just sets it sets the tone. I mean, you know instantly that this is not a fun movie. Yeah. And and it maybe you remember in the end when you see little sister is already dead, but you see her like how she spends the day like on the swing. There are like these moments she appears ghost-like as well.
It just struck me because, as I said, it is a fantastical element, but it's not used to fantastical purposes. It even fits in with the realism in a strange way, I think, but it adds this elegiac note that the film, I think, does very successfully. But Patrick, as you already suggested, I think realism and reality and probably also the contrast to fantasy is something that's going to be there with the other films that we're going to be looking at as well. Should we perhaps take this as a moment to move on to the two next films, Only Yesterday and Pompoko?
Yes, absolutely. To Only Yesterday, its original title, Omoide Poro Poro, actually means Memories Fall Down Like Rain. And it is the title of a manga, Japanese comic book. And the manga itself, I think it was Miyazaki who found it and he was interested in it, but he didn't see a way how he would translate it into an animated movie. So he gave it to Takahata. And interestingly, the manga itself is just focused on the childhood memories. You have, I think she's probably in her 12, 13 years old, Taiko. And what Takahata did, he added the adult, like the contemporary timeline to the movie. Just want to shortly tell what's going on in this movie. It tells the story of unmarried 27-year-old Taeko, who decides to take a few days off. She lives in Tokyo and she has a desk job, and she wants to visit the family of the elder brother of her brother-in-law in the rural countryside. It is not just a vacation, but she is not sure how she wants to go on in her life and what to do. And she goes there for a harvest of the safflower, which is probably quite hard work. And she goes there to her farmer relatives. On her train journey, she begins to recall memories of herself as a schoolgirl in the 60s then. I think the story is set in 82 and... Then we go back to the 60s, and the film always switches between memories of the past and childish romance, puberty, growing up, all the things that are important for a young girl. And it switches to scenes from the present with absolutely adult issues of like career, love, relationships as well. And she comes to the conclusion that she wants to stay in the countryside instead of returning to Tokyo, and probably start a relationship with the cousin of her brother-in-law, Toshio, which is probably like the important like second male character in a young farmer she falls for. But it's very open in the movie. I don't know what you thought about it. It's obviously the how he uses design. We have a realistic part that is like contemporary time. When we see Taeko as an adult, it looks like a Ghibli movie. Even more so, Takahata wanted to be more realistic even for this, and he tried. It's hard to say if he really succeeded, but he tried to show like muscles in skin, facial muscles, which often are a bit strange when you first see them. You have to get used to the style. And it was a first because it's not usually done with Japanese animation. They actually pre-recorded all dialogues that are set in the present and did all the animation afterwards. So he felt that it would be more realistic. On the other hand, we have the memories from the past, and there you have like the characters are drawn like manga, in manga style. It's very simplified, you know, like compared to when it's set in the present. And you have always like the image that fades to white at the border. It's really clear when you are in memory or when you are in the present. But then he uses like tricks when she is in the train, that suddenly like her younger self would peek out of a compartment. So he mixes like reality with imagination or abstraction. It's the question is, it's one more time we ask ourselves, the story is not that interesting in a way. It is, but it's just, why do you do that as an animated movie? I mean, why not a live action? And of course, it's already answered with the possibilities you have to show the past.
Like you mentioned, Patrick, you know, when you look at the story in the abstract, it's like, it's okay, this person is reminiscing and she's going on a trip to the countryside. And maybe even she finds a little bit of love. I mean, what's so interesting about that? But that's the beauty, I think, about a Takahata film, because I think you could make a film about literally anything. You could probably be just staring at a pond with, you know, leaves sailing through it, and you'd still be interested in why is he doing that and what's the point of this? Because I think he has this sort of through line straight to the soul of whatever he's trying to depict. And if you look at Only Yesterday, you could describe it simplistically as 27-year-old has a midlife crisis. I mean, that's one way to describe it, right? But there's a reason why he spends so much time on those memories. And if you look at it, the present version of the protagonist keeps talking to the people around her that ideally she's there to live in the present, but she keeps talking to them about the past and things that happened to her. So clearly, she's not been able to let go of her past. And if you look at the movie's through line, the entire reason why she's doing this trip is to find a way to live in the present. And that's really something that you see in, towards the end, where she needs to let go of the things that have made an impact on her. You very rightly mentioned that, you know, the past scenes look like they're drawn in manga, because one of the things that does it, it helps you exaggerate the emotions that you would have felt in the past as well. Compared to the present, where there's almost the uncanny valley effect that you're talking about, where you can see the muscles in her cheeks when she smiles. Yeah, it does take you out of the moment, but you never get that feeling in the past, right? And I felt that most keenly when it was the most mundane things you could think about, like when they all sit around a pineapple and like, okay, what do we do with this thing now? And one of the most relatable scenes in this entire movie was when we see her mathematics score. She actually scored higher than I did at that time, by the way. And so when it comes to division, dividing fractions was her problem, and she still has a problem with that as an adult. She asks a very relevant question, right? She takes an abstract concept where the educational system has taught them, if you want to do this, just do it like this. Just, you know, invert the numerator and denominator, and don't ask questions. Don't ask us how this makes sense or why, just do it. That's exactly how I was taught, and it was exactly what my mom and my sister did to me. Like, don't ask questions, man. Just go ahead and do what we're saying and get on to the next grade. And if you look at it, she makes a lot of sense. Mm. She's got a sense of intuition, like, okay, if I were trying to divide an apple this way, how would I do that? She's not very successful. But you can see how this attitude takes her throughout the rest of her life. And that's something that I think is a through line with that entire movie. So yeah, that's absolutely one thing that I think in terms of realism, that's why Takahata does this. The other thing is I don't know if you guys will agree, this is probably an overt simplification, but if you compare Takahata and Miyazaki, you will see that Miyazaki is all about the epic and the fantastical that slowly leads into the more personal, intimate moments. But if you look at Takahata, he does the exact inverse of that. It's all about the personal and the intimate that lead into fantastical, right? And then comes back down to earth. That's one thing that I noticed about him, and that's also part of how he does the movie.
Absolutely. When you're in her memories, he is free to show things, and so it's abstract, and he uses it. And because it's Erebus, it's really anchored in this realistic world, the more the other moments they show up. And what you said, Eric, is very true, because you said you had like the same similar memories, and I think that's the trick, that I think everybody who watches this movie finds himself in one way, because it's these little mundane things you actually forget and you probably don't even think important to be told. But it's these little moments that make it so rich and so wonderful to watch. And there are these little things like when you remember, I really like how it does it. When you remember this moment where she is with the boy and he asks her, do you like cloudy weather or do you like sunshine? And then the boy says, or is it she? She said that, I like the cloudy weather. And there is just for a moment, just like 2 seconds, you see a ball that is caught.
Yeah.
And it's probably the reaction the boy has, because there is this moment of wow, and from this on, like, she has this crush and starts walking up into the sky, and then she even, like, the way she moves, it's not like Superman, but she starts, like, swimming in the air, and it is so such a wonderful, you really feel how she feels, and with these moments he is able to show feelings, make them visible.
I also find this contrast between Miyazaki and Takahata fascinating. And I think, Eric, what you said, I haven't thought of it in those terms, but I think it rings very true for me that the one starts with the epic and then moves towards the intimate, and the other way around with Takahata. And they do kind of meet in the middle. I think there's many moments in both that remind me of the other, but it's usually the ones where they kind of step out of their usual style. I read on Wikipedia, as one does, that Takahata was inspired in part, at least, by the French New Wave. And I think I definitely see that in a way, the contrast that Miyazaki, I wouldn't say that he's Spielberg, but he does some things more like Spielberg. There's more sentimentality, I think, with Takahata. There's no scene I remember that I would say is overtly sentimental, but they both find these kind of moments of utter reality in kind of islands and everything else that are extremely relatable, that are extremely human, that I think are really nice. Since you mentioned the epic, is this perhaps a good moment to move on to the second film that you looked at, Patrick, Pompoko?
Yes, we can. I just had one question. I don't know how did it feel to you when labor is depicted? It gets this socialist imagery to me. I mean, did it happen to you as well, that you got this, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah, I think there's definitely this element of, I mean, it is a film that is also in part, I think, very much propagandistic, is perhaps saying too much, but I think he has a very, very clear view on this organic farming, which I don't know whether it was a new trend at the time. And of course, that is depicted in ways that makes it look extremely attractive and obviously the best option, which it might be. But I have to say, me, it did take out of the film a bit, perhaps also because I didn't expect to come to this film watching, you know, almost an advert on organic farming in Japan in the 80s.
It did take me out the moment they mentioned the word organic. I was like, wait a minute, isn't that a millennial trend? Like, they predicted that in the 80s. That was my first thought about that. And yeah, there is definitely a way to look at it, like, as possibly pushing that message in terms of, yeah, you know what, you're in the big city, you're doing all of this, you're not feeling particularly energized by your work. Why don't you just come and walk the land and, you know, be a socialist? You could look at it that way. But I would think that the broader reason why we're seeing that is not necessarily because Takahata is trying to persuade us about a certain ideology. Again, this is just my opinion. I think it's more because if you look at every single thing that Takahata has done, the common thread beyond what we've spoken about is that they're all very pastoral. They're all based in the reality of nature. And if you see, a lot of them are about getting back to, well, the way things used to be, instead of, and we're going to get into Pompoko, and it's about, you know, gentrification and industrialization and, you know, the whole eco-conservatism angle. That's part of the ideology there. But I think that's something clearly you can see just how everything's depicted. Again, if you look at the backgrounds, they're lush, they're lavish, they're amazing. And I don't think that most artists would really pay that much attention to just the entire greenery around. So at least that's what my take from that is, that like Miyazaki, they both really love nature.
Absolutely. But with Pompoko, where we have it to another extreme, I think it's political as well. It's because I always have this feeling that there is, I don't know, I never read really about that, but I have this feeling that he had this like socialist idea still a bit there, how like societies should work together. And it's there with Pompoko as well. Pompoko, to give a short idea of what it's about, again, its original title is Heisei Tanuki Gassen Pompoko, which means it's the Heisei era Tanuki War. Pompoko, which is the sound that Tanukis make when they beat their bellies. Just for people from English-speaking countries, the translation of the dub was a bit misleading, because sometimes those tanukis are incorrectly referred to as raccoons, which is not the case, because it's about these Japanese raccoon dogs. They are, in Japan, they're considered to be magical, and they're shapeshifters, and as the foxes as well. The film tells the story of a group of tanuki threatened by this gigantic suburban development plan. They are like different families that fight against each other, but then they are forced to decide to unify to stop this development. And they are trying to use their illusion skills, but they have to relearn them because they forgot about them. They don't remember, are not able to shapeshift as successfully as their ancestors probably. So they stage this huge, massive ghost parade and hope like to show humans that they should stop invading their space. But this doesn't work really, because humans believe it's a public stunt of a theme park. And so they have to find new ways. And this setback, they are no more all working together. They are separate smaller groups, and some are more and some are less successful. Like one is really doing like using eco-terrorism, and they others, they try to get their attention through TV and explain themselves. Or another one is an older one. He probably a bit senile. He starts this Buddhist dancing cult, and they all and leads everybody of this little group to their death. So they really fail. And in the end, it's like this strange situation that you have this one tanuki that breaks the fourth wall, and the first time in the film talks to the audience and just asks humans to be more considerate of tanukis and other animals. And this is kind of how the movie ends. It's you watch them not succeed. But one more time, it is so weird. I remember watching it the first time. This movie comes up with so many, probably not understandable for non-Japanese people, details and elements, be it from religion, be it from Buddhism, and Japanese culture. It's always like imagining like these, what they do with their testicles. And it was like, oh, wow, yes, I would never have expected such a thing. And it's really funny in a way, but at the same time, it is really sad. And this is a thing that we find in many Takahata movies. And again, he switches again with styles. When we had like in Only Yesterday, we had like the past and the more like manga style characters there. Here he uses this really fluently. You remember at times you see the tanukis like extremely realistically drawn, like the animals themselves for short moments, and then they change themselves like into it looks really like a typical Ghibli character. But then at the extreme, most extreme, when they are mad or angry or fight, they turn into these really reduced manga style characters that are oversimplified. And the use of these elements is quite fascinating to me.
Absolutely. I think it's definitely the film that just stylistically, in terms of how it plays with style and different tones and moods, I would say that I found this probably almost the most complex film, which is something that you definitely don't expect of a film about what you think might be, you know, cartoon animals with surprisingly prominent testicles. Eric, what are your thoughts on the film and the things that Patrick has just mentioned?
Yeah, I'll have to agree with Patrick, because when I first saw the Calvin and Hobbes moment, I was like, huh, okay, so they're going that way. But then they took it to another level to also show you the emotional state, right, and exaggerated just that little bit by reducing them to that chibi-fied version, if I could call it that. So, yeah, I'm sure we're going to talk about testicles, but before we get there, in terms of ideology, like we just mentioned, right, this you could look at this movie either way, I think, because in one way you could see that the kitsune, the foxes, are really like, you know, the movie's argument for capitalism, which eventually the tanukis have to go with because they don't have a choice. Whereas the tanukis themselves are more free spirit, socialist kind of community where they just want to survive and live off the land and just be happy with their own, I wouldn't want to call it means of production per se, but just living in symbiosis with the human community coming up. Obviously, that doesn't work. So in terms of complexity, like you mentioned, Matt, this is a very complex film. But when I look at it, when I step back and I look at it in terms of affect, like how does this affect me? I would say that it didn't really affect me all that much because a lot of these things don't really jive. If you think about it, if you're going to do an indictment on capitalism and you have somebody like Takahata's reputation for being a slave driver, and you're running an animation studio that way, but there are still stories about how he ran the studio to this day. How does that really gel with the process of making this film under those conditions? And that's one of the things that, when I look at it, I can't separate both of those aspects from what the movie's trying to tell me. So it's a very complex film, like you mentioned, and I have very complicated feelings about it.
Of course, that's true. And it doesn't impact me as like Only Yesterday does. And I don't know, maybe it's because it's very strange culture-wise. There's happening so much that I don't think I understand, or then I try to, or I get it. But it's, yeah, it's this complex thing that probably hinders to really be as approachable as the other movies, as easy to understand. And even with the title, the original title is this long title that is, it sounds a bit like this war epic, Japanese war epic movie. And so it makes fun of this. And I always think that Takahata, he doesn't really trust in our generation, because it's the same what he said for Grave of the Fireflies. He sees this boy just failing because he is no more able to really see it and do it. And it seems a bit similar that these tanukis, they just fail because they are no more able to really work together. And in a way, it's this sadness that you find there. Did you feel similarly when watching it? Or
yeah.
I mean, I definitely had that. I think also it's the film of the four that we're talking about here that I at least know how to feel about it, which probably ties in with what Eric said. Part of me finds that interesting and even productive. Part of me also thinks it might be that the film has just a few too many shifts. I think you can see the film as lots of separate things. You can watch it almost as a kind of fantasy epic at times. You can watch it as a, you know, child-friendly cartoon if you are okay with your children watching big hairy testicles. You can also, I mean, I think, Eric, you brought up the term eco-terrorism, if I remember correctly. And I think there's also that. There is a story in this film that is not too different from, you know, other films about activist groups that then split up into different factions, the terrorists. And I mean, let's face it, this is a film where both the Tanuki and human beings die because of eco-terrorist attacks. So there is that element. There's this kind of, you know, it's, in a way, an ideological political faction that we might agree with falling apart because they cannot agree about how best to go about this. But then, yes, you have basically the Tanuki having the kind of adventures that I think kids would love to watch, even if their parents would then have to explain what exactly these things are that they use to float. There's a cultural element here that makes it difficult for me to place what I see and understand it and know what the film wants me to think about them. I'm not sure the film wants me to think a specific thing because it just keeps bouncing back and forth. And I find that mercurial aspect that the film is 4 or 5 different films, I find it fascinating. But at the same time, it also left me almost a bit exhausted by the end.
Mm. It's quite long and it feels quite long. I mean, I remember rewatching it and I thought, oh, now it's over. And then, oh, no, it isn't. It still goes on. So I am not sure if you really needed to tell all these things in order to to tell us what he wants to be understood. One thing is, a thing that goes with all Takahata movies is that you really have this objective realism, which is you never identify with a character 100%. It's you always observe. You always observe the character, and it's very much so for Pompoko, where you have the narration. There is this nice women's voice telling us a story, and it's very polite and very almost like in a documentary, and you just watch them fail, and in between you have these hyper-fantastical moments. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting movie. Indeed, that has to be said, and it's wonderfully drawn. I mean, it's a joy to watch it.
And I don't know, do we have any more specific things to say about the Tanuki testicles, or shall we move on to the last film?
Well, it's probably the only movie that I know of where people die because of being smacked in the face by them.
And that is possibly a concern, too, because it probably wears thin after a while.
But I think testicles seems to be, I don't know if it's a Takahata thing, but probably it's a Japanese thing. And because in Chia the Brat, there are like two cats. She owns a cat and there another cat is like a Yakuza cat, always shows up. And there is a fight. And quite early in the story, this Yakuza cat, he loses one testicle. And it's always like this thing that he is ashamed that he just has one testicle left. And this is quite an issue there. So it's not new for people who are probably for Japanese. Probably it's a Japanese thing.
That's true. That's absolutely true, actually.
But I mean, it's obviously it's not exactly the same thing, but it also makes me think of Only Yesterday, where there is a distinct lack of testicles in the film. But there is one of the flashbacks about the adolescent girls and how basically some of them start having their period and how that's an issue at school. And I think that's something I find fascinating about Takahata, that a lot of the stuff that you would not expect in animation generally is still there. These are human beings, or they're raccoon dogs, but still there's a physicality. There's, again, I think it's this interest in something real, in something naturalistic.
Yeah.
That he does not like. That's my impression, that Takahata didn't like prettifying things to make them whatever people might think is family friendly.
Yeah, and I think that's a distinction that anime actually has compared to any other genre on the planet. Anime doesn't really care about whether it needs to be family friendly or not, because I think it's the only animation genre that has a movie like Perfect Blue, which if you look at it, that would make an amazing live action movie, and it did. And Aronofsky went and adapted it into Black Swan. But Takahata specifically, yeah, like you're saying, it's about the naturalism part of it. And like Patrick was saying, the Tanuki are famous for their shape-shifting as well as their testicles. Apparently, it's Japanese folk myth. And that's the reason why it's not going to be looked at askance if it's a Japanese audience watching it. For us who've not been exposed to that, well, their testicles in the past, it's a little different, perhaps. And if you think about it, they actually have the songs that glorify their balls. I mean, they actually sing about their balls in the movie.
Yeah. And you see them when you're in Japan and in front of the restaurants or places like this, you will find all these Tanuki statues. So it's an everyday thing. I mean, they are part of Japanese culture.
Yeah.
And probably when we go to the final opus of Takahata, we can see that he, through his movies, he focuses more and more to Japanese culture. It gets more Japanese with every movie. And we'll not discuss My Neighbors the Yamadas, but again, here it's everyday life. And it's one of the sweets, actually one of my favorite Takahata movies. It shows a family, and it's very simplified in style, and it's another approach. Takahata, I don't know if we will just cover this part of Takahata, like how he develops the style, design style of his movies, that he tried to find new ways, and he simplified, and he studied like the older scrolls and wood prints of Japanese artists, Tokusai or whatever, and he felt that he wanted to go back to like the starting point of anime or manga. And with the moments in Only Yesterday, where we have like the past, which is simplified as well, it's very white and bright backgrounds. And we will find that again in the Yamadas, and we'll find it in Kaguya Hime to a more, even more extreme and amazing perfection. Yes, it's very, very Japanese. And this is another way I kind of like it, because the realism itself in Japanese animation cannot be really found, or not in a wide way, in American animation, because I think the tradition of American animation bases on comic strips and on cartoons and on like caricature. There is no real interest in realism. So this is just different. I mean, you feel when watching a Japanese animation, after some time, you forget that it is an animation because it's just a movie. And you never really feel that when watching a Disney or a classic American animated movie.
Absolutely.
This is probably always why we think we have to discuss, why is it done as an animated movie and not as a, just a live action? And ironically, like Disney is redoing all his animated movies into live action movies, or kind of live action movies, which is really interesting, this development of where film is heading to.
Yeah, you're right, Patrick. And I think the reason for that is because if you look at the Disney template, it places restrictions on the format. Okay, you can't talk about this, you can't do that. But anime doesn't look at it from that perspective. It looks at, if I can animate this, I can do something I maybe would not have been able to do in film. And so they look at it more as animation, as a lack of restriction. So I think that's the perspective that allows them to do something like this so fluidly, move from child-friendly to more adult themes.
In an interview, Takahata once said that one other reason he was fascinated about animation is that he thinks that the audience is not really paying attention when watching a live-action movie. They don't pay attention to detail, but they have to in an animated movie, because animation is, it recreates our world, but there are no coincidences. I mean, there's nothing just happening because it happens, because everything is set. So in a way, when you watch an animated movie, there is this abstraction from a live action film, where I'm talking like ordinary films now, not about like all these CGI movies, which are, well, debatable animation as well. But it's this attention he asks audiences to have, so you exactly are able to show what you want to show.
Eric, do you want to take this moment perhaps to lead over to the last of the four films?
Sure. So the last film then, The Tale of Princess Kaguya, it really stands out for me because when we talk about Takahata, Grave of the Fireflies was actually one of the first things I've seen. Not counting Heidi, which I would have seen when I was six, but I immediately didn't mention that. The second film I actually saw after that was The Tale of Princess Kaguya. And probably like most people who've been introduced to Ghibli and so on, they were probably led into Kaguya because of the double bill that was going to have with The Wind Rises. So I was intrigued. I was curious. Okay, so if a man can make a movie like that, what could this be? And as it turns out, The Tale of Princess Kaguya was a long and drawn-out project. It actually took years and years, I think more than 7 years for him to do that. And Patrick, like you mentioned, right, for my neighbor's Yamadas, he went for the different art style altogether. There was a lot of study dedicated to maybe making things a little more like, you know, ancient Japanese illustrative styles like Sumi-e. The interesting effect, and I don't know if you heard this, is that Miyazaki got extremely irritated because it kept breaking the animation process for Ghibli every time he did these experiments. And for Kaguya, if you look at the documentary, there's a bit where, you know, someone says to Takahata, you know what, are you going to break things again this time? And later on, people say, can we just stick to this timetable so that we can get this movie out on time? To which Takahata says, I think we can always fiddle, which is an interesting way of looking at it. Because, and I didn't really mention this before, the one reason why I really relate to Takahata is because every story you hear about him from Miyazaki, Miyazaki is your biggest source about the way Takahata does things, is that he was always late. He was never on time. And Miyazaki calls him Paku-san, which apparently is the sound he made whenever he entered the office, because he's always eating bread and drinking water at the same time. So when it came to Kaguya, which had this incredibly protracted development period, I was interested in what the result would look like. And my God, it was absolutely gorgeous. Now, this is probably a divisive opinion, I don't know. But when I look at Kaguya, I don't feel the same things I do with Grave of the Fireflies. Grave of the Fireflies has a very defined illustrative style. It is a little different because they use brown outlines to make everything look a little softer compared to normal anime. But Kaguya went specifically heavily into the lots of negative white space, lots of charcoal and lots of watercolors in there. And my God, you could freeze any frame in this movie and put it on a poster and just hang it up, and anyone would be proud to have that, right? So that was the first thing that hit me about it. The second thing that really hit me about Kaguya is, if you look at it, and there's a lot of debate about this, you could look at it as a feminist folktale, because the key character of Kaguya is, of course, Kaguya Hime, who basically comes down from the moon in the form of a small baby in a bamboo shoot that the bamboo cutter finds. And what I find most interesting about this movie is not the folktale that's adapted from. It's an interesting folktale, no doubt, but about the little bits of detail that Takahata, throughout the experience in his life, he's been able to observe people and just put on that frame. So it's the little things, like, you know, how Kaguya Hime is when she's born, when she's a baby and she walks around. You can see that these are people who have studied how babies and toddlers actually react and walk around. It is amazing. And that was probably one of the things that really, really fired the flames of my adoration for this man. Because, okay, so he's pedantic, he's a slave driver, he's always late. That kind of sounds like me. And that's the reason why I started to pay more attention to it. And then after you get through the art styles, when you start to actually look at the story, and I'm not going to go into the details of the story, but Tale of the Bamboo Cutter is essentially where, like I mentioned, a bamboo cutter, and his name is Okina, by the way, in the original story, which literally means old man. That's his name. The movie gives him another name, of course. But he finds this baby in a bamboo shoot, and he brings her home to his wife, and they raise her up. And they try to keep her happy, because obviously she's a gift from heaven. So they try to give her everything that she thinks that she would want to be happy. And then there's, of course, there's the famous courting scene where all the suitors come to her, and they've heard about a famous beauty, and she's having none of it. She's like, well, I didn't ask to get married, so I'm going to give these people an impossible task. Because, again, this is set in the 10th century, 11th century Japan, the Heian period, where women didn't really have much of a say in what happened to them. It was more or less what the father or the country really wanted for them. So her only, and this is something I read, her only ability to have agency here is the ability to refuse. And that's how she does it. I thought that was pretty powerful. It's part of the original folktale as well. But then it goes on a little further with an extended segue into why she needs to go back after the prince tries to take her away. And basically the people in the moon need to take her back because her heart cried out. And then when she realizes what she's done, she realizes that she actually wanted to stay. And she wanted to experience more of life on Earth, but it's too late. And the movie wraps up in a fairly tragic manner, but also in a very interesting manner that that we'll go into. But the end of the story is essentially she goes back to the moon, and everybody who, you know, who was part of her life is basically left bereft of her, which is, quite a powerful way to end, and also very depressing. I felt really depressed at the end. But I think it's also got a powerful message, which Takahata himself said later on, but we'll get into that. So yeah, that's what really stood out for me. How about you guys?
There's so much to pick up there, and I would definitely agree that, I mean, just aesthetically, it is an extremely striking, amazingly beautiful film, and not beautiful in a just kind of pretty way. I think there's a depth to its beauty also that ties in with the characters, with the story, that has a sense of history. I mean, as you said, it also goes back to much older aesthetics in Japanese culture, but at the same time, there's a... It doesn't feel like pastiche. It never feels like pastiche, because there's also a very modern energy to the visuals of the film. I mean, I'm thinking of some of the scenes where she is running away and form almost dissolves. It becomes much more abstract, and not just abstract in a cartoony way, but abstract in a way that where it almost loses all representational aspects. It's no longer a clear-cut representation of the human form, but it just becomes pure movement. And that is something I find absolutely fascinating. I mean, we talk about Miyazaki, and I love Miyazaki, but I think with a Miyazaki film, I've never found myself, after watching three or four of them, I've never found myself completely surprised by what he does stylistically. You know it's Miyazaki, you know there's going to be flying scenes, you know there's going to be certain styles, and that's also okay. Miyazaki does Miyazaki fantastically well. No one else does what he does so well. But with the films I've seen by Takahata, I find myself surprised so often by what he does and how he does it. That is totally there in the aesthetics.
I think it's always like he just really does what he wants to do, and he doesn't care if they usually do it. Mm-hmm. So I think what you said is like, I was like so overwhelmed even by this moment when she runs away and everything dissolves. It's very, it really expresses the feelings to the point. I mean, you don't have to see more to understand what's going on there. And this is fantastic. To me, this is like animation at its best, when it's very artistic and it puts the whole thing onto another level to compare to other animated movies.
Absolutely.
It's the same. I always had these moments when he uses like real life, not in Kaguya, but maybe you remember like the Pompoko when they watch TV, then we have like what's going on TV is like drawn when it's a person talking or what. But then they have this moment when it's about food and you see real life footage of cooking show. And it's so funny because you don't expect it to have like real life elements in animation. And it's similar today with Kaguya, where he doesn't give a damn. He feels like this is the only way I can express what I want to tell, and then he does it.
I feel that with him, there's almost an element of avant-garde at times, which obviously is not there with Miyazaki. He is very much aware of tradition and uses it, that's my impression, but he is not bound by convention.
Absolutely. You're right, Patrick, when you said that he doesn't really care what other people think. If he's got a vision, he'll follow it through. And you mentioned for only yesterday that they did the audio recording first to get the emotion. That's also something that they did for Kaguya. And I think we can see the reason why he did that, because that scene that you mentioned, where she runs away after the suitors, she overhears the suitors saying basically that she can't be a princess, she must be ugly. So she's this caged bird who needs to fly, basically. So she flies away. And that's a very deliberate stylistic touch that Takahata brought. He even said that, I think you feel emotion if the artist can draw it as fast as possible. And that's the reason why that scene devolves into that impressionistic format. And it's almost like a counterpart to the flight of fancy, the literal flight of fancy that happens later on in the movie. Mm-hmm. I think both of those speak to the kind of same level of emotion, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's also, I mean, again, coming at this from a Western point of view, and we've all mentioned Disney before and growing up with Disney, that these films are not just happy to, but I think they're almost eager to not give the audience what they want, not give the audience the ending that they want. Especially if you come from Disney, if you hear princess, you're going to expect, you know, a film where, you know, boy and girl get together in the end and everything is happy. Yep. And by now there's more kind of feminist-ish elements in these films, but still, where you're going to end up, you know exactly. Now, I think I knew some of the folktale that Kaguya is based on, but still, just having a film like this that is so okay with frustrating what the audience might want, because it's the right thing for the tale. I mean, I think of these four stories, it's the most melancholy tale, and it embraces that, which doesn't mean that there aren't moments that are funny, that are joyous. Absolutely. I think you still have a blend of many different tones in this film, but I think more so than the other three films, for me, Kaguya manages to bring together these tones into something cohesive.
I think it's really his magnus opus, because you find everything that he used or did in his past. It's very personal, I think, and you feel it. I once read that Takahata himself was extremely happy that Miyazaki was so financially successful with his movies in order so he didn't have to be as successful as he, because he knew he would find probably a smaller audience. So he was relieved of this pressure to be like financially successful. So he could do his own thing, and which brings it on a very high artistic level, in my opinion.
True. Did any of you feel shortchanged? Because I'm only asking this because your Western audiences, not us, of course, we're of distinguished taste and we know what's happening. But like you were mentioning, Matt, when you hear the word princess, you know what's going to happen. But towards the end, you find out that Sotemaru, is that his name? You find out that after they finish that little flight where they're like, you know, if I had only stayed here with you, I would have been happy. And it comes back to Earth. He realizes it's a dream, and you realize that he's married. I mean, he went off, he had his own life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And any other tale would have said, okay, these two belong together, let them be together, and let them have a Romeo and Juliet ending if that should be the case. But this doesn't really care about that.
Mm-hmm.
So like you mentioned, Matt, it doesn't really pander to the audience. So how did you feel about that development? Because it's not part of the original folktale.
I greatly enjoyed it because probably one element here is that melancholy is possibly the tone that resonates most with me. And I very much dislike, in a way, the, I think, toxic cliches when it comes to romance that you have in lots of Western films. So to me, this is, again, an element of naturalism. And I think the moments of joy that the two of them have together are beautiful. I don't think they lose in meaning because the two of them don't end up together. If anything, that would be a move towards the sentimental that I think would, for me, damage what is there.
Absolutely.
I just see that we've been talking for a fairly long time. I mean, obviously there's more to talk about, but perhaps we can slowly bring this to an end just to make sure that the audience also gets to listen to other podcasts next to ours. Perhaps just to finish with, we've now talked about, you know, what we love about the films, what we love about Takahata's work. Can I just ask the two of you, if you were to recommend any of the films that we've talked about to a first-time viewer, which one would you recommend and why?
I would have to go with Grave of the Fireflies, because that was my introduction to Takahata, and that was my eye-opening experience. So if anyone who hasn't seen his movies yet is listening to this, then that would be my recommendation, because I hope for them to have the same experience that I did, just opening up my mind in terms of what's possible.
What about you, Patrick?
Oh, it's hard to decide, but yes, of course, Grave of the Fireflies is probably it speaks to Western audiences as well, and is easier to understand probably than his later movies, where I think if you have some knowledge or interest in Japanese culture, it would be easier, of course, understand or have fun with the later movies. And then I really tend to Yamadas, because it's so sweet and light and on the point. It's full of love in my eyes, and it's another one. I would pair those two.
Yeah, it's a difficult one because I think, like Eric said, you know, Grave of the Fireflies was my first one. And I think in some ways, because it doesn't have the same kind of stylistic, aesthetic play, it also... it's perhaps a bit easier to watch because of that, but at the same time, it's also a damn depressing film. And I could imagine there might be people who watch it and will say, that's a very good film. I don't ever want to watch anything else by this guy. I do think that I would also say that Kaguya is probably the Takahata's magnum opus. And it is probably the one that I've come to love the most. At the same time, I think I would want new audiences new to Takahata to work their way up to it in a way. So I would probably also go with Grave of the Fireflies, and if that means that they're only going to watch that one, well, that's a risk I'm happy to take. Okay, thank you both very much. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think there's so much to talk about here, and it was great talking about Takahata's work with the two of you, so thanks a lot to the two of you. Thank you very much, as always, to our listeners. I hope that you're all okay out there, and I hope that you'll get to watch lots of cool films before long. All the best. Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.
Same here. Thank you, Matt. And thank you, Patrick, for making it a very entertaining discussion.